Hey, everybody, it's Virgil. I'm sitting here in the Roxy Hotel with former Greek finance minister and professor of economics, Yannis Varoufakis. Thank you so much for joining us today, Yannis.
Well, thank you, Virgil. Thank you for having me on this fantastic podcast.
Oh, why, thank you. Have you listened to it before?
I've heard a lot about it. So, and it's all good, especially the business model and the way that you combine good quality politics with fun.
We do like to have fun here. You have fun too. Right now you're involved in a very new, very fun project called DiEM25. Could you discuss what you're doing over there in Europe?
Well, we're trying to do something that is completely and utterly mad, but to do it in a reasonable way. Europe is a very big place. It comprises, as everybody knows, many different countries, more divisions than unity. And yet we have a common crisis across Europe, which is causing a fragmentation and a toxification of our societies. So the crazy project that we have embarked upon is about creating a transnational, unified, pan-European movement. Not a confederacy of a French movement, a German movement, a Greek movement, but one movement across the whole of Europe with one agenda that tries to run simultaneously in elections everywhere. That is a completely daft project. But at the same time, it is the only thing that can prevent the postmodern 1930s, which is descending upon Europe at the moment. At least that's what we think.
You have in addition to DiEM25, there is a transnational party that's going to contest races in the European Parliament and then races on a national level. And you yourself are running for the European Parliament in Germany for that list, but you're also going to be running in Greece in the next elections there. Is that right?
I thought you were doing something really mad.
Yes.
but look, DiEM25 is a social movement. We began as a movement, the purpose of which was to bring people together to have a discussion about what needs to be done differently, how, and what kind of new politics we want by which to replace the old cynical politics of the past. Now, for 2 years, we had this conversation, 120,000 of us, and we decided that we think that now we know what needs to be done about funding an anti-poverty program, about dealing with the banking system, dealing with all the things that are disintegrating our lives. But of course, the thing is that when you reach that conclusion in a quest for a program, you realize that nobody gives a damn about it until you bring it to polling stations and you threaten the existing parties with a program that they don't have and they don't really want to engage with. So the movement begot what we call electoral wings, electoral vehicles, political parties that are all under the movement. So to put it slightly differently, the movement has not degenerated into a political party. It has created political parties that are hanging under the umbrella of the movement, controlled by the movement, in a bid to prevent ourselves from becoming party apparatchiks.
And this movement is called the European Spring, is that right?
That's correct. We call it the European Spring because we don't mind failure. You know, the Arab Spring failed abysmally. The Prague Spring failed. The Athens Spring in 2015 is defeated, but we believe that heroic defeats are a way forward.
So it's interesting here because it seems like since the financial crisis, the left, the far left, has achieved its greatest level of electoral success in Europe than it's achieved in years. Syriza winning in 2015, winning two elections. Jeremy Corbyn taking control of the Labour Party and denying Theresa May her majority in those snap elections there. But it also feels like, from my sense of things, and I'm not that big of an observer of Europe, it also feels like these stronger socialist parties in Europe are becoming more cloistered from each other. That Labour in the UK is increasingly, you know, on the side of Brexit, increasingly Eurosceptical. As far as I understand it, Mélenchon in France is, you know, has some views about building socialism that seem at odds with a pan-European viewpoint with the EU.
I hope I won't break the heart of our socialist comrades who are listening, but I don't agree with you. I think that the left has been an abysmal failure across Europe. Yes, we did win in 2015, and that was a majestic moment, especially not so much a victory that brought us to government in Greece in 2015, but the fantastic referendum in the middle of that summer, in July of 2015, that empowered us with an amazing mandate of 62% of the Greek population, who didn't just become socialists overnight, but they empowered us to carry on the fight. And yet that same night, my prime minister and our party completely capitulated. And from then onwards, we have one defeat after the other. I will also disagree with the view that the Labour Party is becoming increasingly Eurosceptic in Britain. I don't believe that is so. If you look, Britain is a very, very divided society, and so is the British Labour Party. But the majority of the members of the Labour Party are Remainers. And with Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, the shadow treasurer, we campaigned together in favor of Britain staying in the EU. And Jeremy agrees with this to this day. But at the same time, you know, we lost the referendum. So we have to respect, as Democrats, the verdict of the British people. So the difficulty now for the Labour Party is to find the middle road between respecting the democratic verdict of the referendum and at the same time minimizing the harm done to people through Brexit.
Well, don't the rules of the EU prevent Jeremy Corbyn from achieving aspects of his very ambitious program, nationalizing the railways, for instance?
No. No and no. Let me remind you that in 2008, we had nationalization in Britain, as well as in other places, which exceeds anything that Vladimir Ilyich Lenin did in 1917. Remember? They nationalized the whole bloody banking system. And the EU never stopped them doing that.
We were on this panel last night, and I want to go back to this discussion that we had then. It's a discussion that we actually have on this show, because we have a sort of comradely disagreement among our co-hosts, and that's on the question of electoralism. And my colleague Matt Chrisman, I know from my extensive and frequently drunk discussions with him, is someone who is more or less opposed to electoralism, and he cites the example of 2015 of the Syriza government. And this essence of his argument is that, look, even if you could get to this point where you can capture power with this, with a majority support, with a very popular platform, and you come into office and you say we're not going to compromise, we're going to fight, we have a mandate, and we're going to do what we said we would do. This will bring you into conflict with capital, and capital is just so powerful that chances are you're going to blink. And that, I think, is a very fair depiction of what took place in 2015 in Greece.
Absolutely, it's totally correct. But that is not an argument not to contest other elections. And to our revolutionary friends who detest political processes and electoral processes, two messages for me. First, I detest them too. I've competed in elections, I've won elections, and I can tell you there is nothing uglier than that. Mm-hmm. I absolutely loathe it. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, what's the alternative? Revolution? Hasn't every revolution we've ever had not failed, from Spartacus to all the way to the October Revolution in Russia? Every revolution eats its children and spits them out, and in the end gives rise to some kind of authoritarianism, which is beyond belief. The fact that every revolution has eaten its children is not a reason not to have a revolution. The fact that every election of a left-wing government has led to disappointment is not an argument not to compete in elections. As I said yesterday in the event that you and I participated in, every generation is condemned to fight the same struggle again and again and again. But you know, all these failures are what changes the world.
Usually the counter-argument here is, no, instead of participating in the electoral arena, we need something like block-by-block community organizing. We need perhaps a renewed labor militancy, wildcat strikes, and that these are the institutions through which the proletariat can actually, you know, flex its muscle. That's where the actual power is.
Well, this is where the power is, as well as at other levels. Militancy at the level of neighborhoods and the level of the factories is absolutely essential. I don't want to downplay it. But we need to get Congress. We need to occupy the Fed. Mm-hmm. We cannot allow the bourgeoisie to control the production of money, the distribution of wealth, and the laws of our communities and our state. while we confine ourselves to the level of organizing, the level of communities and factories.
DiEM25, that's a very interesting list of personalities involved with that. It's you, Negri's on there, Slavoj Žižek's on there. I think Julian Assange is on there. How did this all come about? It seems like a very eclectic group.
It's not eclectic at all. It may look that way. What happened was, when I resigned the ministry in the summer of 2015, there was a lot of pressure on me by colleagues in the Greek parliament to start a Greek party, and I just couldn't do it. We had just been defeated by our own party. This is a message to our friend who despises electoralism. I just didn't have the will to continue along the lines of yet another national political party.
Yeah.
And then I remember in that summer I was in a field in the middle of nowhere in France, and 2,000 or 3,000 people came to listen to me and some other left-wing politicians in France talk. And I realized they didn't come because of me. They didn't come because they wanted to show solidarity with the Greek people. They came because they were really worried about their hospitals, their own schools, their wages, their pensions, because they knew that what was being tried out in Greece by the creditors, by the oligarchy, was just a test run, a grand rehearsal for what was coming in France. And at that point, of course, I was reminded of the importance of internationalism. A couple of weeks later, I happened to be in Berlin, having coffee with a friend of mine, a Croat philosopher, not a Slovenian philosopher, a Croat philosopher. I'm not talking about Žižek, I'm talking about Šeško Horvat. And he said to me, so what do you want to do now? What's the next thing for you? And I thought about it and I said, it would be good to have a pan-European internationalist progressive movement. He said, yeah, do it. I said, are you crazy? I'm one person, you and we're having coffee. What are we going to do? Anyway, next morning he called me up and he said, remember that big, huge, fantastic theater opposite us at the cafe? The Volksbühne, an icon of the left. It was built by workers for workers back in the 1920s. He said, well, I booked it 3 months from now. Let's start the movement. So we began. And we issued an open call and said, who wants to come? And those crazy people that you mentioned, you know, Žižek and Noam Chomsky, and all of them, they said, yeah, we're on. So the game. It's self-selection, as they say.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, let me ask you, the word socialism doesn't appear anywhere in the DiEM25 manifesto.
No, because I've had enough of this word. I've had enough. I'm a socialist and, you know, I've so much harm has been accomplished by those who pretended to be trading for socialism. It's, you know, it's a bit like democracy in Iraq. People hear the word and they take cover because they think the American Air Force is going to bomb them any minute now.
It's interesting because we
don't need it.
Here in
we're socialists, but we don't need it. I mean, here in the United States, it has not been abused because, thankfully, socialists were already eradicated in the 20s. So they never got any chance to do any harm. So you can revive the term socialism and run with it. Good luck.
But in Europe, that's not the case. And you're, so what, I mean, what?
Well, listen, when I was a young man, I joined something called the Greek Socialist Movement, PASOK. Which was a very interesting movement at the time, and then it became the greatest organ of the oligarchy. Later, you know, I joined the Syriza party, which was a radical left party, and look at what they're doing now. They're implementing every austerity policy that the sick mind of our creditors has thought. So I'm falling back increasingly to an older term, democracy. But democracy not as in the American Democratic Party, which sucks, and we all know that. But in terms of how Aristotle defined democracy, and he defined it as a regime, a system of government in which the poor control government because the poor are in the majority. That is a good socialist ideal.
You know, the DSA here in the United States, they dropped out of the, Socialist International, right? The collection of the socialist parties in Europe, they voted to do that last year.
They did very well.
And in you have the example of PASOK, and you have the example of Syriza, that they're socialists, and then they go into austerity and neoliberalism, and so they blink when they face down capital. How is what you're proposing going to be different? And I mean, that's a question for pretty much everyone.
No idea. If I were to answer this question, I would be lying to you. I don't want to lie to you. The best I can do in terms of an answer is to say that it is essential that our movement continues to comprise people who loathe the idea of being in office. Anybody who likes the idea of being elected to Congress, to government, to be a secretary, a minister, a president, a prime minister, whatever, should immediately be disqualified.
Mm-hmm.
We should look at office, elected office, in the same way we look at taking the garbage out at night. Something that is ugly, we don't want to do it, but it must be done. So as public service. And as long as we maintain continual grassroots democracy within the movement, so for instance, in Team 25, we vote about everything, and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday almost. You know, there's a vote about our policies, about what are we going to do in Italy, what are we going to do in Poland, and so on. There's a chance. There are no guarantees, because the nasty side of humanity is always just below the surface, ready to pounce up and destroy the best and the most humanistic of projects. This is why the Progressive International that we just set up with you know, the Sanders Institute in Vermont, we have two colors, black and red, like the old anarchists.
Mm-hmm.
Red for revolution and the heart, and black for the dark side that resides in each one of us.
Star Wars.
No, Star Trek. I hate Star Wars.
Oh, okay.
Star Wars is just so American.
Well, that's a discussion for another episode, I think.
Oh, let's have it. It's an important discussion.
You mentioned the Sanders Institute, and let's talk about something that you announced there. You co-signed this letter with Jane Sanders, the head of the Sanders Institute, Bernie Sanders' wife, calling for the formation of a Progressive International. What are the goals with that?
Well, isn't it remarkable that after the gigantic crisis of 2008, the only people around the planet who've been organizing internationally are the bankers on the one hand and the fascists on the other,
yes.
And we progressives are killing each other and disagreeing and not collaborating. We're just such a sorry, ridiculous lot. Isn't it time that we created the Progressive International by which to fight, on the one hand, the so-called liberal establishment, which, as I keep saying, is neither liberal or not very well established anymore, and on the other hand, the Trumpian fascists?
But what does this actually, what does this look like in practice?
Well, it's a very bare bones, simple organization, not at all hierarchical, and not at all megalomaniac. We're not going to create an international organization that will rule the world. What we want is a network of trade unions, of political movements, social movements, of political parties, of municipalities that create the basic infrastructure for us to be able collectively to develop answers to basic fundamental questions that progressives cannot leave unanswered, like what do we do, how do we fund the green transition that we all talk about?
Yeah.
It's one thing to say we want a Green New Deal for the world, but where will the money come from? And we don't want just, you know, hand-waving and generalisms and wishful thinking, we tax the rich. Yeah, but exactly how do we do it?
Mm-hmm.
And do we need to tax the rich so much, or can we print the money like they have been, you know, the rich have been printing in order to distribute to one another after 2008? So these are important questions. How do we fund an anti-poverty program? How do we distribute wealth, redistribute wealth within our countries and between our countries, which is absolutely essential? If we don't do that, we cannot really talk about the Green New Deal. These are questions that previous generations try to answer. So the first international, Communist International, tried to answer those questions, and there were some very interesting answers. Even FDR and his administration during the war tried to answer that question, and the result was the Bretton Woods system. And it was an audacious system. It had some very interesting characteristics, and very progressive ones. For instance, you know, completely defanged the financiers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the financiers hated Bretton Woods. These, therefore, are the questions that we, this generation, must sit down and work out at the transnational planetary level.
Certainly, but you know, you say yourself, and you've written recently in these op-eds about DiEM25, about your new projects, that the European project is falling apart. The resentment towards Brussels, towards the EU, is increasing, especially from the far right, but also from some sectors in the left. Here in the United States, we feel like, by and large, that, you know, we are siloed off from the rest of the world. And even on the left here in the United States, democratic socialists here prioritize the American working class, which often whose interests can often be in conflict with, say, the proletariat in the global South. How can you, you know, we solve these problems, we think about a global New Deal. That's something that necessarily involves massive wealth transfers, right? If it's going to have a moral basis and actually solve the question of climate change. How is that sold to Americans, working class Americans, working class Europeans?
Easily. Well, firstly, anybody who calls themselves socialist, democratic socialists of America, of Yemen, of France, of... let us remind ourselves how the whole thing began. It began with workers of the world unite. Mm-hmm. It did not begin with workers of the world divide and look after each other and don't give a damn about workers in other countries in the world, mm-hmm. right? Point number one. Point number two. We all know that the way in which the global oligarchy of the Davos Foundation, of the Davos kind, the way they prevail and the way they manage to reproduce their privileges is through a race to the bottom. Pitting one working class against the other. So the obvious thing to do is to have a progressive international. And anybody who thinks that they can create socialism in one country, let me remind you that that was Joseph Stalin's project. It didn't work very well, because even if you have a large country and you manage to create a worker state without the internationalism that we are proposing, all you end up doing is reproducing patriarchal authoritarianism within one country.
You're in the United States, so you just came back from the Sanders Institute up there in Vermont, and you went to the president. You said, Bernie Sanders absolutely must run for president. So what is your thinking on that?
Well, my thinking is really very simple. Bernie Sanders' run was almost accidental back in 2016.
Oh, yes.
Almost accidental. Just like Jeremy Corbyn's success in usurping the leadership of the Labour Party. But, the best things in life happen as a result of an accident. That run unleashed a great deal of progressive socialist potential in this country that even socialists in this country never thought that this country had.
Absolutely.
When he won Wisconsin, I thought, my goodness, I didn't know they were socialists in Wisconsin. and you can see that in the midterms that just happened. So many progressives, especially women, rode the wake that Bernie Sanders had created back in 2016. With a process of empowerment of minorities, of women, of progressive ideas that is remarkable. This is too fresh, too recent to be left to its own. In other words, if Bernie doesn't run again, I very much fear that this momentum is not going to be maintained. For better or for worse, presidential runs are wonderfully capable of concentrating the mind and turbocharging these small tsunamis. Now, I do not believe in particular personalities. I believe that all of us, as individuals, are accidents of history. So if it wasn't Bernie, it could have been somebody else. I'm not saying that Bernie is irreplaceable. But today, as we're speaking, end of 2018, as we're approaching the 2020 election, I believe that I can't see anyone else who can energize or continue to energize progressives in the United States
other than
Bernie Sanders. So he has to run. Mm-hmm. He has a moral responsibility. I don't give a damn about whether he wants to run or not. I don't mind his age. I don't mind whether he feels that he has what it takes. He's got to run, and he better run.
He is a million years old, you realize.
Yeah, okay. So what? 79, 7. I'm pushing 60, you know. So
really?
I'm
you look great for 60.
I'm
My
not
God.
That far off.
I'm just thinking, if I were 79, I couldn't run for president. I couldn't run for anything.
Well, you know, but the beauty of life is that the best laid plans lay in ruins. I was planning by the time I was 55 to retire to the island of Aegina, and look at me now.
I remember, Bernie Sanders ran he started that campaign in 2015, not to win, but to make a point.
Yeah.
And then he won the New Hampshire primary by landslide. Then
you wish for.
Almost won the Iowa caucus. And you realize, oh, shit, I've got to run a real campaign now. And what's fascinating about that is, this was supposed to be a coronation for Hillary Clinton. And I remember it very clearly. you know, I was very cynical. Most on the left thought, okay, it's just going to be Hillary. We're going to focus on the grassroots. We're not going to focus on the presidential election. I remember watching those debates and just hearing things that I never thought in my lifetime I would ever hear on, you know, national television.
Yeah, talking about poverty, for instance.
Talking about poverty, talking about, say, for instance, you know, we don't need 50 fucking brands of deodorants, you know, in the market shelves. Or that, you know, I'm glad that I'm not friends with fucking Henry Kissinger. And I thought, that's amazing. And that's the message that you never really hear, that never never gets a platform in the media. So, I mean, I'm definitely on your side on that question. And I definitely absolutely agree with you on the necessity of electoral politics. I think we're about running out of time, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this. I know you've gotten this question before and you brushed it off a little bit. So, but I have to ask you again, is Common People about your wife?
Well, you may very well say this, but I couldn't possibly comment because this was written years and years before I met my wife. But I can tell you that she was a student of sculpture at St. Martin's College.
Yes. Well, I mean, I just think if I met Blair a year ago, and if she were to come up to me one day, if she had been, say, the topic of, I don't know, champagne supernova or something, I feel like she would have just mentioned it at some point.
Well, I didn't say that she didn't mention anything. I'm saying that I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay. Yiannis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining us. Next interview, Jarvis Cocker. We will get to the bottom of this. I promise you, Chris.
I'm looking forward to hearing that next interview. Thank you.